Welcome back to Brain Biohacking with your host, Kayla Barnes. We dive into all things optimal health, optimal brain health, nutrition, peak performance, cognitive excellence, biohacking, longevity, and so much more. Robbie, it is such a pleasure to have you here with me today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. We were just talking all fun Austin things. So you're located in Austin. And for anyone just joining, Robbie is the co-founder and CEO of Force of Nature, Force of Nature Meats specifically. And I can't wait to discuss all things regenerative farming, meats, cuts, how these animals live, how they're raised, and so much more with you today.
Well, again, this is what I love talking about, and I hope to raise awareness with well-intentioned consumers and folks out there eager to learn and be a part of a solution-oriented system. So I'm grateful again for the opportunity and excited to get into it.
Yeah, me too. Okay, so let's start with the basics. What is regenerative farming?
Yeah, it's a complex approach to agriculture, and yet it is, you know, the least intensive or industrialized. If you think about how complicated and complex our current approach is, or we've had to engineer and force through mechanization and other sorts of innovation our will and dominate landscapes to produce food, you know, that's really complicated. But regenerative agriculture is sort of a a way of looking back to the wisdom and the fundamental gearing and engineering of nature to produce food. And so it basically says, hey, we've had to combat nature in so many different ways and try to force outcomes against the will of nature. And it's become more and more challenging over the time. It takes more herbicides to kill weeds. It takes more fertilizer to produce crops. It takes more tillage and more disturbance and disruption and devastation and damage and dead zones and oceans and death of insects. And it's harder and harder as nature evolves to work against the will of those natural cycles and systems. And what regenerative agriculture is, it says, whoa, instead of fighting and combating nature, why don't we work with it? Why don't we recognize it's billions of years of symbiosis and science and biology that instilled fertility into these land bases and through the beautiful mechanism of diversity, you know, created resiliency in these systems that produce food. And you know, we all evolved eating and thriving on natural landscapes. And it's only been a recent thing in the last generation or two that we've began mining that fertility without participating in that system that restores that bounty. This is a recent challenge. And I think we veered off path with the best of intentions, but it's really clear the side effects, the unintended externalities that the industrialized system, the green revolution has begun to produce. And I think it's fair for us to say, hey, we had a good intention. We got off path. We can at least own and acknowledge those challenges. And let's pivot this direction and correct our course and choose a path forward that produces just as much food, but it's healthier and it has fewer externalities, whether that be human health risk, whether that be loss of land, whether that be welfare issues for animals or social issues for people. Let's work with nature instead of against it and replace a vicious system with a virtuous one.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and I love all that, but there's a lot to kind of break down from what you just said. First, let's talk about when did the farming system really start to change and what did they start to do? I'm guessing the purpose was to produce more food, right? That's why they wanted to go away from essentially regenerative agriculture in the past and they wanted to make more food or mass produce food. Can you talk to us a little bit about the history of like when this started to change and then the impact that it's having on us and the animals and the land?
Yeah, and at the highest level and simplest form, you could go back to, well, I think the most recent series of changes kind of go back to World War II, or even World War I, actually, excuse me. And some of these companies that produced, chemical agents for war, for weaponry. We figured out how to reuse those facilities and those technologies that were developed with urgency to create fertilizers. And so then we could all of a sudden, we no longer needed to work within the laws of nature to ensure that we weren't abusing the land or were looking at the land like a bank account. You know, you can make withdrawals and you can cut checks, but you still have to make deposits. With the advent of some of this chemical amendment, whether it be fertilizer or herbicides or pesticides or fungicides, we started to figure out we could cheat it, and we could say, we can just extract. And with these cheap chemical inputs, we can kind of cheat to an outcome. And as I noted a moment ago, we did that ignorantly because we didn't realize that the efficacy would wane over time and we'd have to continue to raise the stakes and increase the inputs and increase the toxicity of those chemicals and those inputs. And what we also didn't recognize is that we were mining that fertility and that there was a shelf life of that. If you don't make those deposits or invest into that system, at some point, even the best technology and the best chemical amendments aren't going to be able to produce the outcome that you're looking for. And then I would say simultaneously, there was we call it the Green Revolution tractors. You're able to till and force your will on the land, and you could spray more of that stuff over more acres with a gas, petroleum engine. And then from a policy perspective, the USDA came out with a program called, basically said, go big or go home. And instead of being a nation of farmers where, in 1800, we were 60% farmers, in 1900, we were 30% farmers, and now we're low single digit farmers. The average age of a farmer is over 60. Most farms are going out of business. It's kind of a hopeless thing, pursuit. And, from a policy perspective, again, you look back in the 40s, 50s, it was go big or go home, get big and efficient and mechanized and industrialized, or we don't want you. You're in the way if you're not, becoming part of this hyper efficient, global industrial machine. And so I think that sort of myopic, those policies, that myopic thinking, that very human thing that we do where we are convinced that we know all and unintended consequences should be ignored and we can just kind of manipulate and innovate the world around us. And we continue to get ourselves deeper into holes unknowingly. I think we did that same thing with agriculture. The intentions again were, hey, let's produce more food. Let's reduce the cost of producing food. Let's create stability for the nation. Let's create stability globally. And then I think those original honorable intentions became perverse. And then we start to justify shortcuts and justify mistakes. We need to feed a growing population. Therefore, any compromise in value is necessary. Well, that's disingenuous at best. We don't need to feed a growing population. Debatably, the population might not be growing if you look at some data from certain countries and stuff. And the people that you say that we need to feed may want their sovereignty and not want us to impose our technology-based food on them and so on and so forth. So I think that's a long way to answer the question of how we got to where we are. And the last thing I'd add in the States is the farm bill. There are significant taxpayer dollars going into creating incentives to play by the rules they want you to play by. And I think that was done to support farmers and ranchers initially, and through some really challenging and trying times. And I think it's been captured now by large food businesses who have recognized that they can get really cheap inputs and raw materials by leveraging taxpayer dollars to supplement and to support those systems. And so that's why and where most animals are fed corn and soy, and you see corn and soy in most of the food in the grocery store, that points back to these incentives from this farm bill that are at taxpayer expense saving some large companies billions and billions of dollars in profit.
Can you elaborate on the farm bill a little bit? what is it offering to farmers, or what was the first intention and what has it kind of turned into now?
I think the first intention was a backstop, a contingency for farmers and ranchers, where if, you know, you're trying to grow food and it's hard, and if you have a total failure, your crop, you have no rain, a hailstorm, but, you know, some invasive pest species moves through and destroys your crop, you know, you're out of luck. And the government was able to come in and say, hey, I'll tell you what, like, we'll give you this insurance program. We'll make sure that you get paid to justify taking that risk. We need people producing food in this country. I think that's pretty reasonable, you know, sort of insurance approach. And I think what's happened is, again, even that's been captured to the point where we're flooding our own markets and the international markets with cheap industrial commodity crops. Again, commodification, I always call that, or define it as chasing price above all else at the expense of all else. So anything goes, any compromise, any cut matters, as long as it cheapens something, even if you lose value along the way. And, you know, we now produce corn and soy in many cases, and sell it on our markets. And the price we sell it for is less than the cost of production. And yet, we're now, you know, we're recently, as a few years ago, sued by the government of Brazil, and we're having to pay them $180 million a year, actually, because we were flooding international markets with corn at less than the cost of production, which is unfair. But we're doing the same thing to, again, the grocery store. You look in all the boxes that have all the corn stuff in it. Well, there's a reason everything has corn in it. It's not because corn's the best. It's just because it's cheaper than the cost to make it. So why not use that ingredient in everything if it's that propped up? Even you look back to the farm bill, and, you know, around 95-96, they made some changes that reduced the cost of feed for animals, and that saved the Tysons and Purdue's, you know, tens of billions of dollars over a short period of time, because the primary feed that goes in to feed those animals got cheaper. And then they engineer, you know, selectively breed animals to thrive and convert those crops specifically, because they can, you know, now they're GMO'd and they can spray them with, you know, Monsanto genes, and farmers can't get seeds from them, but it's predictable and it's inexpensive. And so, you know, it becomes this really complicated web that ties back to large businesses and influence and lobbying and incentives. And the farm bill's sort of been captured and is a representation of the no longer the interest of consumers producing nourishing, valuable, healthy food, or flavorful food, or local food with an eye towards the impact on those land bases and the ecology, and an eye towards the, you know, the actual social issues and outcomes of the food producers and those communities, and an eye towards, you know, all of those, those original stakeholders that this program was designed to support. And now it's really perpetuating the status quo by those that have a vested interest in the status quo at the expense of consumers who are now registering glyphosate and breast milk and urine, and farmers who now have a rate of suicide higher than veterans returning from war and are losing their land at accelerating rates, you know, thousands and thousands of farms a year. This is their identity, their sense of self-worth, their purpose. You know, the system is failing the people it was set up to save, and they're virtually, you know, sharecroppers now, just struggling and desperate to keep their land and their way of life in a system that's squeezing them and squeezing them out.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a disaster. Thank you so much for explaining that. So let's talk about the soil now. So you made some really great points that we're not making deposits into the soil. I feel like I always hear Mark Hyman say we don't have, and I could be getting this wrong, but it says something like there's not going to be enough land in like 60 years to support the amount of food that we're going to need, and especially organic land. I've read up a little bit on like desertification is the way that you say the word, right? Like these lands turning into deserts where produce can no longer be grown. So what does it look like right now? Can we fix it if more people move towards regenerative agriculture? Do you think it's too far gone? But talk about why the soil is basically in the state that it is now? Because I don't think a lot of people understand where we're at with that.
Yeah, I think, you know, to paint a grim picture before giving hope, and just to color it for folks listening, you know, if you think about the dawn of human life, you know, we point back to the Fertile Crescent. You know, it's an area that is now a desert. You know, and I think that's a representation of this area that was so rich, and it was thriving, and it had the capability to produce, you know, a bounty such that, you know, our own species could spawn and thrive and grow and become what we are today. You know, there's an example of not honoring our resource base and allowing it to desertify past a point of, you know, no return and recovery. And I think you could point to Mesopotamians and Incans and Mayans, and you can look at poor resource management as one of the primary causes. Again, it's all complex, but often what happens is poor resource management all of a sudden creates a scarcity of food, which leads to war and leads to all sorts of things. You know, this is a tale as old as time, and Plato and Aristotle and many, many others have written about food production and soil health as a result of it. And so when you say desertification and what's going on with soil, you know, basically a third of the surface of the earth is possible to produce food on, is available to agriculture. So there's like 30 billion acres, like 12 billion acres are suitable for agriculture. Most of that is still arid, rocky. You know, it's mostly suitable for livestock agriculture. It's not prime land. Our prime lands are like the plains of the United States. You know, there are these fertile grassland systems that have become the primary food production systems for the globe. And again, we've been mining those and through industrial agriculture, been really pushing and forcing and dominating those landscapes. And if we don't allow them to function as they've evolved to function in very complex systems of plants and an incredible array of life underneath the soil and above the soil and animals, you know, all the harmony, all the roles, all the synergy and ecosystem services, if we disrupt that, it starts to deteriorate. And that's what desertification is. It's saying, hey, you've taken a rich, thriving ecosystem and you've plowed it and sprayed it so many years in a row that it's losing its capacity to ever return back to its full potential, and you're deteriorating it such that its ability to produce food, its efficacy as a food production base, is starting to be called into question. Simultaneously, and what you were referencing, when you disrupt that land in such a way, not only do you harm it in a lot of ways, but you expose it to a lot of risks, like erosion. And so we can go through some of the principles of soil health. One of the ones is limit disturbance. Don't leave the soil. Another one is don't leave the soil bare and exposed, because that can cause a lot of harms. But you were speaking to the 60 harvests, and that came from a speech at the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization a few years ago. And they said in that speech, we only have 60 harvests left at our rate of topsoil loss. See, topsoil is this thin, tiny, tiny skin or layer on only certain very special parts of our globe that are ripe and appropriate for food production. And it takes 500 to 1,000 years to create 1 inch of topsoil in nature. And we're abusing it and losing it. In fact, if you look, you don't have to look further back than even the Dust Bowl is the most recent example of where we had a national panic because we disturbed that land so badly that we were losing topsoil at such a rate, it was truly eroding away. How that plays out now, and to kind of tie it back to our conversation, as of a couple of years ago, the U.S. Natural Resource Conservation Service, again, which an organization that came from this very problem, estimated that the U.S. is losing about 2 billion tons of topsoil per year right now. 2 billion tons per year. These are such big numbers, it's hard to appreciate what that means. I'll say this. It is our number one export as a country, is our most important resource, arguably. And it is theoretically a non-renewable resource. And it's not one that we want to be losing. It's one that we want to be investing in. And what does 2 billion tons really look like? for perspective. And by the way, the EPA also says the number one pollutant to our water systems is topsoil because of the rate at which it erodes. And 2 billion tons of topsoil, again, per year, looks like a row of the pickup. You just were visiting Austin. You probably saw some pickup trucks. You take those and you fill the back of that up with a fresh load of soil. A heaping pile of soil in the back of a truck is about 2 tons. So you need about 1 billion trucks lined up in a row to represent the topsoil loss for 1 year. It just turns out that wraps around the equator roughly 150 times. So that's how much topsoil we'll lose on an annual basis of a finite resource that we need to survive, that we should be investing in. And that's where that stat of 60 harvest lifts come from, because we're losing or degrading that resource at such an alarming rate. We will not be able to produce food in this system under these techniques in the future. It is not an if, but a when the system will fail us. And so when I'm asked with when I'm faced with questions like, can regenerative agriculture work? Will it feed a growing population? I always have to pause and say, I gotta challenge the premise of that question, because I would say the answer is yes. And further, that the current industrialized system cannot, because it has us racing towards a cliff. Slowing that down or maintaining that to a sustainable rate doesn't change the destination. I do not want to go careening off a cliff. I want to course correct and begin building these resources and improving our food systems and our food production communities and the health and wellness of consumers and the welfare of animals and protecting wild places for future generations.
I love that. But is anyone else outside of, you know, of course, at Forest Nature, this is what you guys are doing, but from a government standpoint, I'm not an expert in this area. Is anything else being done, or are they just like moving full speed ahead and just ignoring all of the red flags?
There is a lot of lobby dollars and interest. Some of the largest organizations, if you think about everything that impacts our food system, you have big food, very influential. You have big pharma. A lot of the pharma companies are chemical companies, and the number one use of antibiotics in the country is our food system. You have big chemical, again, herbicide, pesticide, fungicide. Imagine spraying that across 900 million or so acres 5 times a year, and petroleum to run those tractors across that land base. And so there's huge, true complexes, and many of them that are aligned. Hey, let's maintain the status quo. You know, we are not evil. I don't believe that these are evil organizations. I believe they are profit-driven organizations with leadership that has a fiduciary duty to ensure the profit of those companies. And they're using the lobbying means available to them to create incentives for politicians to help, you know, to progress their agendas and to perpetuate the status quo. I think simultaneously, you have a whole heck of a lot of consumers that are starting to wise up to what's been going on. The wool has been pulled over their eyes. And I think they don't want cheap food. They want food that has values, and they want to be proud of it. They want to form a relationship. They want to understand the impact these food systems have. You know, you do surveys and better for me, better for the planet, better for welfare of animals, better for a set of social issues across the board tests favorably that consumers, all else remaining equal, will prefer that path. And so I think with the information being more accessible and more available, you see more momentum. And so, yeah, there's force of nature, sure, in this space, but there's tons of not-for-profits. There's tons of NGOs. There's international movements. There's international organizations. I mean, as prevalent and well-known and appreciated as organic is now, and organic is not perfect, but it was an important milestone in raising the bar for food. Regenerative is gaining momentum at a rate that is faster than organic did. So that's encouraging. It's encouraging that we're seeing more momentum. It's encouraging that we're seeing more of an awakening and a stand up for consumers. I think you could even look at the challenge of disrupting and bringing this awareness into the commodity sector. You know, you look at the center of the store where there's most of the boxes or the jars of stuff. You've seen brands over the last few decades really start to gain in prominence if they make claims or if they have values that they stand for. And then consumers start to advocate for those brands that represent and champion causes that are important to them and they align with or they feel a relationship and connection with. And then you've seen that extend into yogurt and dairy and eggs. So it's made it into the perimeter, just not meat yet. And meat is so remarkable because 98% of households eat meat still. Not 98% of individuals, but on a household basis, 98% of households are eating meat. And so while the current system is really challenged and needs to be improved, the opportunity is massive. And so, I would say, you know, to your point, your prior question about, is there hope? Absolutely, there's hope. You know, sure, damage has been done, but I all the time, and we can all look and see, I marvel at how capable and resilient nature is at recovering and restoring. And we're not talking about wholesale change. We're talking about subtle change. Let's start working with nature instead of against it. Let's try to figure out how to harmonize and leverage the wisdom of nature with our incredible innovative and technological capacity to again leverage that and create systems and opportunities and build all of the things that we've done for this industrialized system, but do it to support, you know, nature and alternative system gives me incredible hope because the scale is just so massive. And the same thing on plant-based agriculture. You know, we're a meat company, but and meat and animal agriculture, I should say, is challenged. But plant agriculture is just as bad, if not worse. You know, row crop agriculture, monocrop, at some point in time, there could be 600 million acres of corn in the United States. We're talking, you know, the U.S. is 2 billion acres. So when you fly overhead and you look down below you and you see a checkerboard, that's the size and scale of the impact that we're talking about. All that land, you know, in order to produce all of that corn, you have to till it and it kills everything. And you have to spray it to kill everything extra good and then spray it for the plants and then for the weeds and then the insects and then the fertilizer. And it's just a really, really vicious system. So and that's to produce plants. So I don't think plant agriculture deserves a free pass. I don't think animal agriculture deserves a free pass. I think the way we produce food in this country, animal or plant, needs to be improved. And so I don't buy into the plant-based is better or the animal-based is better. I think I always say planet-based agriculture. It's plants and animals thriving in harmony and functioning ecosystems. That's where our food always came from and should continue to come from for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. I think it is interesting to talk about the plant-based versus carnivore, I guess. We won't go into the entire argument, but all the time. Well, so obviously I am not plant-based and I am not vegan. And I actually started posting like beef liver and just like raw steaks on my Instagram. So I really hate to say this, but I'm just going to say it. So that I wouldn't have so many vegan commenters because it would be like a super long thing. And I run a business. I don't have time to like read all these things, but I think there's so much confusion around from vegans. And if you're doing it, you know, for the right reasons, then so be it. But I mean, can you just talk about how many animals are killed for soy?
Or it's a great question. And look, I'm right there with you. And I think, let me just say this about vegans specifically. I have a hell of a lot of respect for vegans, right? I wish more people paid attention to what they were eating, considered a greater constituency and group of stakeholders beyond their own self-interest when making food decisions. The sacrifices that vegans make, that cannot be easy to eat that way. And then you see the health compromises that they're making and obviously the myths that they're being lied to, but when you talk about being considerate, they're being incredibly considerate, even if sometimes they're misguided in how they go about trying to perpetuate their religion. So I also always say at the rate of population groups, you know, vegans have hovered around 2% forever, so they're not growing. And so I always say every vegan is a future former vegan ready to happen. And we'll be there for them when they're looking for something that, you know, meat that they can be proud of and that will heal the issues that they have from having gone down a vegan path. But I just wanted to not overly hate on vegans. And then I lost sight of the question.
No, and I appreciate that. And for to be super clear, I also, because if you are vegan, you are at least thinking about what you're eating, which is so important. I just find it interesting that the bulk of the argument is that it's for saving the animals.
Yeah.
But I mean, if we just look at, and we can go down, obviously, what Force of Nature is doing and how you guys are raising animals and the impact on those animals versus, you know, growing soy and all of these, you know, bases essentially for vegan items.
Yeah. On that ethical front, there's a couple interesting things. I'll talk. So for the key point that you're making, when you till the land, you kill everything indiscriminately. And when you spray insecticides, you kill everything indiscriminately. And herbicides and plants are life too. You kill everything indiscriminately. But let's just, for the sake of this conversation, talk about sentient life. For every acre of land that's healthy, there should be about 1 billion sentient lives. And that includes insects, right? We're not talking single-celled microbiology, but we're talking sentient life. And you kill all of that. 1 billion life forms per acre. What does 1 billion life forms even look like? And I'm talking 1 acre. Keep in mind, I just told you agriculture was hundreds of millions of acres in the U.S., billions of acres internationally. But what does the life on 1 acre look like? What's 1 billion life forms look like? If you take a ream of paper that you'd stick into a printer, you know, one of those 500 sheets of paper stack, mm-hmm. about 1.5 inches or 2 inches, roughly. I forget the math exactly. But to get to 1 billion, if you stack that paper up, 1 billion sheets of paper tall, it'd be about 300,000 feet high. That's how much life is in an acre that you destroy to produce industrial row crop agriculture. Your monocrop of corn, your monocrop of soy, your raw material for your soy smoothie, your raw material for your Beyond or Impossible burgers. You're devastating mammals and insects, amphibians, reptiles, everything. It doesn't matter if it's cute and cuddly or it stings and bites. It all dies for you. When you look at, and I might butcher these numbers, but I think it's appropriate to point back to. When you look at the amount of, this is an interesting one too, because I'm going to take a kind of ruminant, beef, bison type animal, and I'm going to compare it to chicken. When you take, I think we kill. Oh no, I'm starting to get, I'm getting foggy on my numbers. I think we kill roughly 30 million head of cattle a year, give or take, to feed humans. I think we kill something like 7 or 8 billion chickens a year to produce roughly the same amount of meat. So again, I think one of the things interesting for the people already eating meat, and this isn't about vegans versus not, but for the rest of us, I think chicken's an interesting one because it's also been given a little bit of a free pass compared to beef. And I'd say chicken is less healthy for an individual. It's much more devastating on the farm. It's much more devastating off the farm. And it takes an incredible amount of loss of sentient life in order to produce the food that we're trying to make this system produce versus, you know, ruminant megafauna that were on the land for generations. So I think those are some interesting numbers when you talk about welfare and moral and ethical issues in food that sort of disrupt a couple of dogmas, right? That veganism means cruelty-free or that chicken is a better path. The chicken one really gets me because I feel like it somehow has been perpetuated at the expense of women, even where, you know, a huge population of the United States, particularly women, is deficient in iron and other really important micronutrients. And they've been somehow misled to move away from healthy, you know, red meat like beef and prefer something like chicken, which isn't going to address their issue. And I take issue with that. So,
yeah, I agree. For the record, I don't eat chicken and I'm also obviously not vegan. So, I mean, it's astounding. So I'm so glad that we kind of covered that. I knew it was a lot of animals, but I did not know it was 1 billion per acre. I mean, that's really something. Okay. And then talking about, of course, in no world, and I believe this for over the last decade, there's a huge problem with commercial farming of cows, right? I mean, the way that they treat them, the things that they eat, do they really feed them Skittles or is this a myth?
That's real.
Okay. Why? It's cheap.
I mean, it does the same. It's like grains, you know, it does the same thing to these animals that it does to us. In a finishing step where you're trying to fight fatten animals up as rapidly as possible. You know, there's a, you have expired chips or candy or something that, you know, can't be sold for human consumption. So there's a really cheap outlet to, you know, bring that into food production system. I don't know how common it is, but it is, but it does happen. And I think it's disgusting, as you do.
Yeah. So in general, when I talk about eating meat or when we're having this conversation and we're going to go into the details of how you guys raise your animals, definitely not advocating for any of this large scale farming. And that's why it's just so important. I'm so happy that as a society, we seem to really be paying a lot more attention. But it's amazing because so many people are like, oh, it's so expensive. And I understand. And I think it's very unfair. And we need like systematic change from the top down because food is too expensive. But if you're spending money on other things in terms of like going out and drinking alcohol or something of that nature and running up a bar tab, I mean, I just think personally, I would much rather invest in the food that we're eating because the health, our health is, you know, the only thing that we really have. And I just feel like in America, we've really changed. We have a negative connotation about how we spend our money on food. And if you have the ability, I just feel like you shouldn't feel bad necessarily spending it on high quality products. So, because at this point, they do cost more. So, okay, let's talk about organic versus regenerative farming, because there's also all these labels, right? There's like non-GMO, there's organic, and then now regenerative farming. There's probably even a couple more. But what are the differences?
Yeah, I think claims and labels have been a large part of the problem that's created confusion. It's created convenient ways for the food industry to manipulate consumers and to feign delivering on the good desires of consumers without having to actually, you know, do a lot without there being a lot of substance or follow through there. An easy example would be rebranding a pack, you know, rebranding McDonald's so that there's some earthy green tones and some tans and it looks a little cleaner. It's the same stuff, but it, you know, we're appealing to our same thing, putting natural on a label, right? It doesn't really mean anything. And yet you really want to believe it does. So you imply or you assume a lot of good intention into it. Organic is a little bit different for plants than it is for animals. Organic was a really important milestone, but it is not a destination. You know, organic does a lot of things. One of the main things it does is it limits and prohibits, you know, treatment, the application of certain chemical pesticides or herbicides, toxins direct, you know, onto the food or into the food system, which is huge because we don't want that in our bodies. We don't want it in the oceans and expanding the dead zones that are there because of row crop agriculture chemicals or waterways or reservoirs. And so I think organic is really important that it showed that against the will of this industry and against the grain and the pull of the status quo, consumers could stand up and say, hey, we don't want your poisons in our food and on our lands and have a huge movement there. What companies do in lieu, they use alternative or slightly greener chemicals, or they till a lot. You know, you don't have to spray weeds if you just till them. And that's really destructive to the land. And so, you know, while it's better, and I would not disparage organic, and I would encourage consumers to purchase organic over conventional, I would say, hey, let's celebrate the achievement and the milestone, but recognize that, you know, the pinnacle, the gold standard that we can see today is regenerative. What other claims do you specifically want to ask about? I think you mentioned organic there.
Yeah, I guess non-GMO doesn't really apply to meat, does it?
Well, it does. In the sense that, you know, a lot of animals, monogastric and ruminant. So monogastric being single stomachs, porks and pigs and chickens, pork and poultry. Ruminant being multi-chambered stomach like beef and bison that can eat grass and upcycle it and do this amazing thing and take something humans can't eat and turn it into the most nutrient dense food on the planet called meat. But when we're supplementing these systems with conventionally grown corn and soy and GMO corn and soy, it matters that those animals are fed. And I think it's important to note why non-GMO matters. I think there's a lot of concern and speculation again around unintended consequences. When you use CRISPR or some other technology and you get into gene editing and engineering, you could be selecting for an attribute that you're focused on, but you don't know what's happening where you're not looking, and we don't have a ton of long-term data. And so I think there's fair questions to ask about what are the real implications. I get that we're delivering a desired outcome, but what are the undesired outcomes that we're not looking for that may come along with this trade-off we're being forced to make? That's interesting. But the thing that really gets me is, again, what are we editing? What are we make? Why are we, you know, modifying some of this food? And when you find out, like, oh, they're modifying soy so that you can spray glyphosate directly on it, and that genetic makeup of that plant will survive that toxic load of glyphosate, and that's why it's been GMO'd. Well, I don't want to eat that. I don't want to eat food that has been doused at incredible levels with toxins that are terrible for me. So I think whether like the gene editing part and like the unknown part, the sciencey stuff, I think that's what most people harp on, but they don't go back to like, oh, they're editing this so it won't produce seeds. So farmers are on the hook and they have to come back to us every year and they can't hold any back. You know, the why behind the GMO, I think, matters as much as the implication of the actual science. And I don't want food that's been modified so that it can bear some horrible treatment that will be adverse to me and animals and land and so on and so forth.
Absolutely. I definitely agree. So talk to us about how you guys raise animals and, you know, just a little bit more about the regenerative process at your farm.
So for clarification, my co-founders, Katie and Taylor, have a ranch in Fredericksburg, Texas, just west of Austin. And that is one ranch in our broad supply chain. They own it individually. It is totally separate from Force of Nature, other than we're, you know, related parties, but separate entities. But it's an example of many, many dozens and hundreds of ranches and farms all across the country and even in some cases internationally that we work with and support. And that's one of the unique things about Force of Nature is we're not trying to centralize and take share. We're trying to almost open source, work with regional producers and processors across the country, across proteins, and make those more accessible for consumers. And at the same time, create more awareness and content and education for consumers so that while they have greater access, they have greater understanding of why they should be supporting this better system. So that's a little bit more about what Force of Nature is. It's not a single ranch. It's a supply network of a bunch of independent farms and ranches and processors. And we're the brand that aggregates and puts that into the world. The practices that would differentiate one of our partner farms from another, again, it varies by what is species appropriate, what is evolutionarily consistent for those animals, whether it's different for chicken than it is for bison, for example, as well as for the land itself. You know, what happens in the Pacific Northwest is a lot different than the arid parts of West Texas. And so it's about working within nature. Where's it, you know, you're not going to grow tropical fruit in Alaska, if you're responsible, you know. But in general, there are principles of soil health that are fundamental to regenerative agriculture that apply, whether it's plants, whether it's animals, across species, breeds, et cetera. And I touched on a couple of those a second ago, but limiting chemical and mechanical disturbance, so limiting spraying toxic chemicals, limiting tilling, disturbing the land. Again, if things start popping up on the land, it's there for a reason. What's nature telling you? What's it need? How do you harmonize and work with that land? Why do you have to till it just because you see a plant popping up? The second principle is, you know, armor the soil, leave it covered. Bare soil in the summer can reach a temperature upwards of 150 degrees. That's higher than the temperature needed to kill pathogens. Soil is diverse and rich with life. If you cook it, you kill that life. You need that diversity. You need that soil life. It's more complex. We understand less about the soil than we understand about the deep ocean or the rainforest. And yet it produces our food. And we need healthy functioning soil ecosystems, because what comes out of that soil is a reflection of the health of what's beneath the soil. And then, you know, what comes out of that soil, herbivores and omnivores will eat, and carnivores will eat, and, you know, everything else will be a reflection of that. So you want to protect that soil from that heat. Similarly, the same thing happens in the cold. And then it's also exposed to erosion. Like we talked about, how much topsoil the U.S. is using, 2 billion tons a year lost due to erosion. So leave it armored, leave it covered, let it protect, hold moisture into the ground. The third principle is green growing plants and living roots year round. When a plant is alive and in the ground, it's doing this incredible thing called photosynthesis. It's taking, we all learned this in elementary school, carbon dioxide comes out of the air and the plant absorbs it, and then it releases oxygen. It's pretty cool. You know, from a science perspective, what's really cool is it basically just took carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the body of the plant or into the soil to feed those microorganisms in the soil, and it released oxygen. So it just took atmospheric carbon out of the atmosphere and put it into the ground, which is really important. It also converts the energy of the sun, the most powerful energy source in the solar system, and transfers that into the soil to keep the soil alive. And those roots break up, so it gets better water infiltration. In any case, nitrogen, atmosphere 78% nitrogen. Nitrogen fixing plants are putting nitrogen into the ground, so you don't need to spray synthetic nitrogen fertilizer, and on and on and on. So let plants do what they're supposed to do, and we can address one of the biggest challenges that we face from an atmospheric carbon perspective. Diversity is the next principle. You know, recognize that everything's got a role in nature, however big or however small. It is diversity that protects us. You know, even insect species, right? For every undesirable pest insect species, there are thousands of desirable species, including many species that will prey on those, you know. And if we unselectively eradicate everything, we create an opportunity for plague and these massive imbalances. So diversity is really important. Again, diversity of plants. Some of those plants are fixing nitrogen. Some of those plants have different shapes of leaves that have different photosynthetic capacity on the land. And then the last two are animal impact. You know, there are no healthy ecosystems that just have plants. It's always plants and animals in harmony. So it can't be one or the other. It's got to be both. Yeah, you think about what made the plains in the U.S. such a valuable resource for us, and why it's been so productive over time. And it's these large herds of bison roaming across, these keystone megafauna. Before that, bison antiquitous. Before that, mammoths. You know, operating in harmony and performing ecosystem services, being keystone species. What does that mean? That means relative to their numbers, they have a disproportionate impact on those ecosystems. So letting those animals do the jobs in those food production systems that they were designed to do, and those systems symbiotically evolved to require. And then, you know your context. Again, I mentioned it a minute ago, but, you know, you shouldn't be trying to make tropical fruit in Alaska. You know, if you're poor but have 10 kids, you got a lot of human labor. You know, if you're a wealthy person, you might have a lot of capital that you can invest. And so, like, how do you find the right mix and balance and be nimble for your resource base? And so those principles universally can be applied in any sort of food production system. And they celebrate the energy cycle. They celebrate the mineral cycle. They celebrate the water cycle. They celebrate so many of these fundamental cycles of nature that I was speaking to earlier. Versus working against them and combating them. You know, I think the biggest challenge with conventional industrial agriculture is it's chemistry based. It's chemical and industrial warfare on nature. And I think regenerative agriculture says, let's take a biological approach and try to work with nature. And I think one important understanding is that we've dammed up rivers and waterways, we've fenced in lands, we've killed predators. So we can't just turn it loose. We can't just stand back as humans and say, all right, let's just let it fix itself, because it can't. It won't. It's been too disrupted. And we frankly do have a need for food production that we're relying on. We can't just cut off our supply of food, but we can make shifts in how we think about and manage our land so that we can celebrate what would have happened historically and allow opportunities where we manage and move animals across a ranch like you know, the bison would have been roaming across the plains and allowing for those cycles to occur. And again, celebrating them and how we manage our lands can, in many ways, emulate what nature was designed to do.
I love that. And I mean, as a side note, the nutrient density of either a plant or an animal that's eating from a regenerative farm. I mean, we didn't really talk too much about that, but the current food supply, it's very nutrient poor. Am I right? Versus if you're doing it in a regenerative way, the nutrient content for the human consuming it is going to be significantly higher because of all the minerals and nutrients in the soil, right?
Yeah, it varies for plants versus animals. There's a bunch of data that shows, you know, the density, the nutritional density of a carrot being like 1,000 times higher in a regenerative system than in a conventional industrial system. And you kind of hear those adages of you got to eat 50 servings of spinach to get the same amount of iron that your grandfather would have eaten or something like that. And so, yeah, it takes way more calories to get the same amount of nutrition that we would have had in healthier systems. And then regenerative, it takes less calories. And I think the coolest study on the meat side of that is a recent one done by Stefan Van Vliet, where he looked at bison and he showed that the, you know, animals finished on pasture and fed a grass diet and living a more evolutionarily consistent life had multiple times higher rates of, I think, 700 out of like 1,200 phytochemicals, and had lower oxidative stress and had better omega ratios. And, you know, the list goes on. And I think he was important to say, hey, look, meat above all else is a superfood and is healthy and you should eat it. And I'm not demonizing the nutritional value of more conventional forms of meat, but I am saying that food coming off pasture-based systems and regenerative systems is significantly better for those animals and for the people consuming them. And they can get many benefits that they wouldn't be able to get otherwise.
I love that. Makes so much sense to me. What would you say to someone? A lot of times I'll get a question about, you guys have an ancestral blend that I love. I love doing like a burger patty. But some people will ask, oh, well, isn't the liver the filter and you shouldn't be eating it? What is your response to this?
We named it the ancestral blend because it would have been the most highly sought after cuts by our ancestors. And if you look at, you know, predator animals, so often they first go for the organs, right? I mean, I think it was what Ty Beal did that is associated. I might be giving credit to the wrong person, but you know, they were looking at, again, you know, talking about those micronutrients that we're deficient in as a society. How much food would it take to give yourself a third of the daily allowance of those critically important micronutrients? And I think it's something like 11 calories a liver compared to like 1,000 calories a chicken. So, you know, they're incredibly nutritionally dense. I think if you were to eat a diet exclusively of liver and nothing else, you probably would be, maybe I've heard that you can have too much, you know, but we're talking particularly in the ancestral blends, a ratio that is significantly lower. And that in those cases, it's, you know, 10% or less, a combination of liver and heart, or in the case of the poultry item, some other cool cuts. And if you think about what our ancestors would have done, they'd be eating the hearts and liver, they'd be eating those organs, you know, but it'd be dozens of pounds of organs with hundreds of pounds of meat to go with it. And so the ratio, I think matters. I think so often, again, look back to what would our ancestors have done. And I think, you know, a mix of organs and meat and making sure that the dosage, I guess, is appropriate or consistent is an important variable.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. You guys offer a lot of bison at Force of Nature. How did that come about? Or is it because of the health benefits? Is it, what are kind of the reasons behind that?
I mean, bison are so damn cool. And they're the nation's original soil builders, you know? They're a truly wild, honest American, exclusive to North America, representation of what nature intended. You know, humans have been following bison across this continent through the millennia, certainly since the last ice age. And Cows, they're not, that's not, they're like dogs. You know, dogs have been bred and bred and bred and bred and bred from wolves. Cows were bred and bred and bred and bred from these wild animals in Europe called Aryx. And so they're cool. They're, I mean, I eat them. I love beef. I eat it. You know what I mean? But there's just something special about, you know, the way it was intended to be, what nature meant. They're wild. They haven't been manipulated to be docile. They haven't been manipulated to convert feed. They haven't been manipulated to produce milk. They're just these badass, super nutrient dense, incredible keystone animals that deserve our respect. And you can't be in the presence of one without, you know, feeling and sensing that in every way imaginable. And just from a business perspective, it's an easier category to disrupt. You know, beef is so commodified and cheapened that to compete, you got to have a certain level, and you got to be prepared to really go onto that battlefield, or you know, these big players out there will mop you up. And I think, you know, that exists less in bison. So it was an easier, obvious first effort and first step for us to go in and raise the bar and elevate and prove that consumers value and appreciate and align with what we're talking about and the values that we're championing. Before doing, you know, and in conjunction, because we've been selling beef, right? But, you know, it's easier to get our foot in the door and on the shelf with incremental items like bison and ancestral blend. And then the light bulb clicks on for these retail partners and they're like, oh, people do want this stuff. Okay, well, we'll take the other stuff as well. So it was always sort of a way to get the door open for us.
Smart. I love that. Well, I cooked Force of Nature, my fiance, and I don't know, I didn't announce it in my podcast, but I actually got engaged in Austin.
I was going to ask if it felt weird saying fiance. I noticed I was about, okay.
Yes. Yes, it does. And you know, what's so funny is that we're actually getting married at the end of next month. So I'm only going to be saying fiance for like a month.
Wow. That is quick. Good for y'all. Okay. Sorry. Back to the question.
Yes. Well, hey, when you know, you know. But anyway, so got engaged in Austin, and I wish I have to come down and see your guys's, I want to see the Rome Ranch and the whole thing. And I heard about the bison experience. Next time we're down there, especially if I'm going to get a place there, I would love to connect with you and do that. Definitely. But anyways, when I was here, I cooked Force of Nature every night and it was unbelievable. Both me and my fiance, big meat eaters. It was actually like a big part of, you know, one of the many checklist items, I guess, that I had was the person I was going to marry had to eat a lot of meat. And they also had to know what good meat was and bad meat was. And he checks all the boxes. But anyways, I love it because we made so many things last week. I made the ribeye, the bison ribeye. I did the filet. I did the ancestral blend. And my favorite way is to do it like sous vide and then just do like a BPA, like stasher bag or something. But really for me, like sous vide, doing that for meats is just like such a game changer because so tender all the way through and just throw it on like a cast iron pan, like 1 minute each side, but it was unbelievable. So, I mean, what you guys are doing is so commendable. It's been such a pleasure to meet with you personally, but this is just what we need more of, you know, and I hope you guys grow like crazy. I have a link, you know, but it's something I'm so passionate about. So I just really appreciate, I'm sure it hasn't always been easy to do this, but it's the right thing to do. And I really appreciate you for that.
Well, thank you so much. I'm glad that you're enjoying the products. I'd remind you and everybody else too, those that to eat the ground meat, you know, there's a lot more ground meat comes off of an animal than steaks. And I know we all love a good ribeye. I'm no exception. But to be good stewards of animals, you know, we got to eat the whole animal. So a little bit of liver is always good and definitely eat, you know, the majority of what's going to come off the animal's ground. And by the way, all that connective tissue, all that stuff that gets ground up, lots of collagen, you're eating a lot of ground meat. You don't need to supplement with collagen. You know, you're getting ample. There's all kinds of good stuff that comes in the ground form and it's really flexible. So I love a good steak, but, become a pro, with ground meat as well. I think that's a really important part of a diet.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And it tastes amazing. Highly recommend the ancestral blend. I mean, you guys are going to love it when you take a look at their website. But I appreciate your time so much. And thank you for joining me today.
Thanks a bunch, Kayla. I appreciate the opportunity. You can check us out at Force of Nature Meets on Instagram and forceofnature.com. And, you know, hope this has been helpful. And again, Kayla, I really appreciate what you do, what you stand for, and this opportunity to tell our story and hopefully resonate and connect with some folks. And congrats on being engaged and having a fiance for a month and a half.
I know. I know. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hacking was created and is hosted by Kayla Barnes. This podcast is for informational purposes only, and views expressed on this podcast are not medical advice. This podcast, including Kayla Barnes, does not accept responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of the information contained herein. Opinions of their guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. If you think you have a medical issue, consult a licensed physician.